Welcome back, everyone, to HGO Football. We're still on the road to Qatar 2022. I said we're not on a long motor anymore. We're not in a country lane. We're almost in a high street. It's on the horizon. We're a couple of weeks out. We're still going down memory lane slightly, though. And we've got a very, very, very special guest. Andrew, looking forward to this one. I'll let you do the honours of introducing our esteemed colleague for this evening. But we are literally in Rio. We're in Rio 2014, but we are also with our guest.
Yeah, we're right closing in now on Qatar. I think we're just pulling up to the junction, aren't we, on the M25 to pull off a couple of junctions away. But we are joined this evening to talk about the 2014 World Cup in Brazil by the one and only Tim Vickery. Absolutely delighted to welcome you onto the show, Tim. How are you? Are you well?
Yeah, very well. Lovely to be here. And looking forward to bringing back memories of an event that was just overpowering in those days of mine 8 years ago. I just had a quick look at the scores and so on. Mm. Did that happen? I don't remember that. I think I was just so busy at the time that the things that I remember very clearly. And lots of other things kind of passed me by.
Yeah, we were going to talk about that, actually, because we don't want to say we've just done the reviews. So we shouldn't say this. We had some nice guests on. But we had a couple of dull World Cups before, in my mind anyway, in 06 and 2010. 2010 was special for different reasons, but nonetheless, quite dull. Well, this was an absolute cracker. I mean, we always ask this, but where were you?
Yes, but. Yeah, sorry, where was I?
Where were you, like, in life? Were you there? Where were you? And what were your abiding memories?
I was in a TV studio or a radio studio or a stadium or going between one of those three places. And it really was no sleep till bedtime. It was massive. It was, I don't know how I got through it looking back on it. And I probably didn't do my health any good, actually, as a result of it. I don't know how much I aged during that month. I agree.
Yes, but.
Yeah. But. And the but is the knockout stages, which were, it's always where a World Cup has to be judged by, you know. And it suffered, I think, from the thing that's been a problem of all World Cups, to my mind, of recent times. And looking at you and your ages, probably all the World Cups of your life, which is end of season tiredness, where you can see as the competition goes on, players are increasingly drained. And maybe I see that quite acutely because of Argentina. Because Argentina in qualification were just gloriously insane. It was unbelievably insane. You know, that they went with a front three of Higuain, Messi and Aguero and Di Maria in the midfield three. And it was fascinating.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, the coach, the former Leeds and Sheffield United midfielder, sadly no longer with us, Alejandro Sabella, he would say, you know, if it's tit for tat, my tit's going to beat your tat. Look at what we've got. You know, I can't leave any of these out. So yeah, we're just going to go for it. And he said, you know, there are times when my team is being attacked, that the only thing I can do is just shut my eyes and pray. But that's the way we're set up. So that's the way they qualified. And then in the World Cup, firstly, I remember being in the stadium for their first game, which was Bosnia, and they lined up in a totally different system. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? It really didn't work. And they made heavy weather of it. And there's a reason for that. The coach had seen they just weren't fit enough to do it. They couldn't play that expansive football. And the goals kind of dried up as I went through the tournament. The vital moment for me, when the destiny of the World Cup is decided, they're one up in the quarterfinal early on against Belgium, and Di Maria goes off injured, and that's the end of him. They don't score another goal. Mm. They don't score in the semi. They don't score in the final. Mm. I feel sad for the people who didn't see him in qualifying, because in qualifying during the season, they were a different thing from what they were in the tournament, and so for me, they are an extremely graphic illustration of the problem that has dogged all recent World Cups. I think 2002 more than any other, but all recent World Cups, and which I think won't dog this World Cup, which is end of season tiredness.
Mm. So you mentioned there, Tim, about the beginning of the tournament, where the verve and the energy is very much there. Brazil kick it off, don't they, with a fabulous night against Croatia, a very amped up national anthem.
Well, see, there's a yes, but there, I think they weren't very good.
No. I remember.
And they won it on a dodgy penalty. Mm. You know, I was watching that. I wasn't there, but I was watching it in the BBC studios with big names of world football. Mm. And, you know, when they got that penalty, all of them were looking, look at that, ludicrous decision. So they weren't great. And for me, one of the most important matches personally from it's a game that I was in the stadium. It was the next one when they played Mexico. Now, that for me is one of the most important games of the World Cup. Why? Right, they beat Croatia, but they weren't great. First night nerves, you know, that's understandable. Never judge a team in the World Cup on the first game, especially a team that's under real pressure, as Brazil were. Second game, relaxed, getting into it. Now you're going to see it. And they weren't very good.
No.
I mean, Ochoa in the Mexican goal had a terrific game. He had a good game. But, you know, I remember the hubbub all along the press box was, is that all they've got?
Mm.
Is that it? And it wasn't just the press that were feeling it. The team were feeling it too.
So was that the moment you knew they're not going to go win it? I know they'll go, obviously, get to semis, but...
No, that's not the moment that I knew. I think the moment that I knew was...
when they were 4-0 down.
First knockout.
Half an hour into the semi.
Well, the first knockout game against Chile when, first of all, they couldn't beat it. They couldn't beat Chile. It went to penalties. And then you saw the emotional state of the team. And Thiago Silva was the captain. And what did he do? You know, you're the captain, son. You rally the troops. He's also a fantastic striker of a dead ball. You'd think he'd be in line to take one of the penalties. He's sobbing on his own. He's sitting on a football, you know, yards away from anyone else, crying his eyes out. You're looking at that team there and you're thinking, this team cannot cope emotionally. Mm. And I remember the day of the semi-final, the Germany one, leaving the house and my wife and stepdaughters, they are World Cup fans, which is very, very common in Brazil. You know, not that into football day to day, but World Cup, they're really in. And I remember saying to them as I left the house, not today.
Mm.
You know, don't get yourself up for today because it ain't going to happen. I didn't expect they were going to be 7-1, but I didn't expect Brazil to win. But the process of the doubts beginning to creep in for me is that 0-0 against Mexico. So for me, because when they joined in the hills outside Rio, Brazil's training camp, they joined together before the World Cup to start their preparation. The word coming out was, we got one hand on the World Cup. The tournament hadn't even started. We got one hand on the World Cup.
Mm.
And you saw that confidence start to drain out from that game against Mexico. Mm. And then once they went behind against Germany and tried to chase the game and lost all of their discipline, you know, David Luiz just running all over the place. He's at fault for the first goal. So he wants to make up for it doing 20 different functions at the same time rather than the function that he needs to, which is organising the defensive line. You're seeing a team which is emotionally out of its depth. Now, you could have played that game 100 times outside the conditions of a World Cup and Germany would have won most of them. They were a better side.
Yeah.
But outside the conditions of a World Cup and the pressures of a World Cup for Brazil at home, they would never, ever again, they would never again lose that 1-7-1.
They would lose 4 goals in 6 minutes. Do you know what I mean? It's just, it was headless.
I mean, that doesn't happen when Real Madrid play a team from the fourth division in the cup or something like that. You know, I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah.
So Fernandinho. No, Mr. Reliable, Mr. never less than 5.5 out of 10 per game ever was 1 out of 10. I still haven't been able to do this. Just to sit down and talk to someone, you know, from the game and say, you know, what was it? What happened? They still won't do it. You know, it's still such a big scar that it's really hard to get people to talk about it.
For onlookers watching on, I remember that first opening game and that night, the national anthem and the emotion in that national anthem. A lot of those Brazilian players, some of them were in tears. And then you look at how the tournament ends for them. And it's an easy conclusion to make, Tim, but was it simply down to just not being able to handle the pressure of being the team in the, you know, Brazil, it's not any footballing country, right? And it's in Brazil, and you've got the weight of expectation on players like Neymar to be the man. You know, was it literally a case of too much pressure?
Oh yes, I don't think they were great anyway. I think they were all right, but they weren't great. But that is, one of the previous World Cups, 2006, when they went out to France, and for that game in the quarterfinal, Juninho came into the team. Juninho Pernambucano.
Yep.
And that was a huge game for him because, you know, Brazilian, he's got a strong link with France, you know, was playing there at the time, played there for years and years and years for Lyon. Mm. And national anthem plays and you see him crying. And I remember thinking then, seeing that, forget about him for this game.
Mm.
And I spoke to him about that a few years later and he said, yeah, it was just too much. So yes, I mean, that was,
you're talking about a mix there of the physical tiredness end of the season for all the teams and then the emotional drain on Brazil. Mm. I think you get to that semi-final, they've literally got nothing left. Do you know what I mean? So the moment it goes wrong, you can't rely on your legs because they're physically drained. And you can't rely on your mental nous because they are mentally shot. And obviously in the 2018, you know, we're not here to talk about 2018, but they go on, they have an average World Cup quarterfinal knockout to Belgium, don't they? So that quarterfinal was a huge one of the old guards in the 2006 one. We were talking about that the other day. France bringing everyone back, Henri 1-0, beautiful time. As a fan, obviously you're there working, you were doing your stuff in 2014, but as a fan, is there a game that stands out that you just enjoyed for it? You know, it doesn't have to be the biggest moments, but a favorite game of the tournament.
Maybe Chile, Chile-Spain, I think. Unfortunately, I couldn't get in for that one. Lots of Chileans did because they invaded the stadium, you know. And quite a few of them got away with it. But I couldn't get in for that one. But I enjoyed that just because anyone who'd followed that Chile side from when Bielsa took over and then on to Sampaoli knew they were great fun. And that was such a fabulous moment for them.
It's the game that sees them through, really, isn't the group? Because it's them or Spain that go through second. I think it's them. Yeah,
that's it. So you know they bring Spain the Spanish reign to an end, which for a little country like dynasty, Chile was hugely important and hugely enjoyed. So I enjoyed that one, and I really enjoyed Colombia. Because again, you know, national teams are, I think a lot of the punditry that goes on in World Cups isn't very good, both by pundits, ex-players and so on, and just by people generally, you know, on social media and so on, because they haven't followed the process. A national team is a process. It's quality, but it's also a process. And one of the things that I do, in what I do, I follow the national teams closer than anything else. It's the main thing I've got, really, the national teams. So I do follow the process. And with Colombia, you know, Radamel Falcao García couldn't make it and people were thinking that's Colombia done. And I was saying, no, this James is the team. And so to watch him really explode, I think it had a hugely detrimental effect on his career.
Yeah.
Being the star of the 2014 World Cup. I think it wasn't good for him outside those 4 weeks in June, July. but I got a lot of pleasure from watching Colombia. We're watching him and Quintero, who's another. I love Quintero. Quintero is what I would do if I was a footballer. Play a World Cup and then just get obsessed with music and eat too much and just get myself fit for the next World Cup, you know, and then come back.
I tend to do that and just not do the World Cups bit. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So, yeah. My favourite game was actually another one in that Spain group was the Australia-Dutch game. You know, it was the 3-2. Which is a cracker, and it had the Tim Cahill goal, the beautiful goal over the shoulder, the volley.
Right.
And I know the James Rodriguez goal, obviously, is not the one that's spoken about that with the Van Persie header. But for me, the Cahill goal.
Yeah, I'm bitter about that James goal because that was in Rio, that was in the Maracanã. And I was going to go, I had a ticket, you know, a press ticket, and the BBC wouldn't let me go. Because I had to do match of the day that night and they didn't trust me to get back in time. And I would say, look, I will get back in time. You know, I live in this city. I know this city. I know how long the underground's going to take to get. I will get, no, you can't do it. you can't do it. So I'll have to watch that one in the studio rather than being there for it.
The two teams you've mentioned, Chile and Colombia, they were for me the standout sides in terms of this tournament, really. Colombia just wowed us all, didn't they? And I think Chile, Tom and I would have had close eyes on Alexis Sanchez racking up the minutes once again in a very, very busy season calendar year for Alexis.
What a terrible confession you've just made. But there you go, I'll let it slide.
Oh, okay.
Well, we slide it in everywhere we can, mate. We have to get it done. We have to get it in there. Which needs to be done.
I remember being in Chile the following year for the Copa America, which they won. It's the first piece of silver they ever won. And there was I was wandering up to the stadium, and you could get all these Alexis Sanchez masks. They were really, really popular. And I thought, that's good. I'll buy one of them. And then I suddenly remembered who he played his club football for at the time. I thought, no, I can't do it.
Yeah.
So be wearing a Granit Xhaka one as Switzerland roar through this World Cup, then, I can only presume. I would love to get your... Go for it.
I was going to say, I wanted to just your thoughts, Tim, on Lionel Messi and his tournament.
Player of, apparently.
Really. I mean, there was that goal against Iran, wasn't there, in the final moments, of wonderful finish, but a dreadful, dreadful performance from the Argentinian side. There was another game, I think, where they nicked it quite late on with
Switzerland.
Di Maria. But for Messi, 2014... in his prime, I guess. I mean, he's always in his prime, isn't he? And you just wonder, like, is that going to be that final? Is that going to be the moment that just would have put him up on that? Well, me and Tom and I, we think he's up there as the greatest of all time anyway, but without a World Cup, to be honest. But your thoughts on his tournament in general?
One of my favourite memories is the first game. I was in a stadium for that one, Bosnia.
Okay.
And again, they didn't play very well. They were a bit of a mess. But you had that moment, second half, when he scored a trademark Messi goal.
Yeah, trademark.
And the ground just erupted. You know, the 1-2 on the edge, and it was almost like he put it in with his hand. You know, it's so precise.
Yeah.
And the stadium just erupted. It's like, you know, it doesn't matter what happens now. We've seen it with our own eyes. But I come back to that thing of end of season tiredness, because you could really see him. And I saw quite a few Argentina games from inside the stadium, and you could see it so clearly how he was rationing himself. Now, he spent quite a lot of the tournament just wandering around the center circle with his head bowed, as if he just dropped his wedding ring or something like that, you know, and then he would spark. But it was totally different from, you know, the Barcelona Messi, who is like always in contact with the ball. But he worked it out. That's what he was capable of doing. So, you know, he would have just a few moments in the game where he'd try and tip the balance.
He's earned the right, isn't he?
I actually think that, I mean, the injury that they've just suffered to Lo Celso is a serious blow. Because in that midfield, which is the best part of the current Argentina team, Lo Celso is the one who has a special relationship with Messi. They're really on a wavelength. So to lose him injured is a blow. So that knocks them back a little bit. But that aside, as a collective functioning unit, I think it's the best team he's played in for Argentina. And he scored in the last less than 2.5 games. He scored 9 goals. It's unbelievable. You know, he's 35, for crying out loud. You know, admittedly, the opposition in the World Cup is going to be stronger than Estonia, Honduras, and Jamaica. But still, that shows you how Argentina are now getting the best out of it, because the midfield is now, that possession game is so good that they're able to pull the opposition about and give him the ball close to the opposition goal, where he can do something with it that will hurt the opposition. He doesn't have to set everything up anymore. And that's something that he had to do more, I think, in 2014.
The prediction tools hasn't won it. I saw the AI prediction on that's predicted the last 3 winners has Argentina beaten Brazil in the final. So I don't know what you think about that. But
yeah, losing Lo Celso is a blow. And also, I worry. Their defensive stats are fantastic. I think it's 2 goals conceded in the last 14. But that defensive unit under pressure, you know, Otamendi under pressure. If I have to back one of those two sides, I would back Brazil's defensive unit over Argentina's.
We'll indulge a little bit more in 2022 shortly, but I just wanted, obviously there was the World Cup 2014. There was, I don't want to say controversy because it's nothing like the Qatar controversy, the tournament being held there, but there was the world's eyes were looking at Brazil for a different reason. They were looking at the juxtaposition, the poverty on one hand, the spectacle, like you said, the show that was being put on. And there was obviously the Rio Olympics 2 years later as well.
That's it.
And so I wonder if you can reflect, obviously you are joining us from Rio this evening. Well, I think we slipped that in, but we'll slip in again just to say, we're live, our man live in Brazil. But the legacy the World Cup in 2014 left behind, did that spiral onto 2016? And is there still a positive vibe or feeling about that era, those 2 or 3 years, or actually not? Because was it another white elephant's legacy?
No. The legacy was extremely poor. I actually think, in terms of the local population, that 2014 World Cup was much, much more controversial than Qatar. Qatar is more controversial internationally. And this took everyone by surprise. The wave of demonstrations a year earlier, at the time of the Confederations Cup, that at the start had nothing to do with the Confederations Cup. At the start, and they started from the left. They were left-wingers, young, demanding free public transport in São Paulo, which is a city that wasn't involved in the Confederations Cup. But those demonstrations, they just sparked a moment and they became huge demonstrations all over the country. And the Confederations Cup became a rallying point, or the spending on the Confederations Cup became a rallying point for the dissatisfaction. I owe that a lot, actually, because that got me on TV. Because come the World Cup, the BBC, they thought, we've got to have someone who can talk about these social political aspects. So that got me on the sofa, where there is no such thing apart from ex-players. So it was good for what I ludicrously call my career. That protest movement, it wasn't there to anything like the same extent in 2014. But that doesn't mean that the kind of sense of dissatisfaction went away. I think you can really see that protest movement in 13, as I say, which initially started from the left, but as the moment when the far right become a huge electoral force in Brazil, that they were the ones it's ironic because the protest movement began from people wanting better public services, and it ended up being captured by people who don't want any public services at all, such is the warped logic of those things. But that has, and we're seeing now as we speak, the election in Brazil was 10 days ago, and there are still people, the far right demonstrating outside military barracks, calling for the military to come in and take power. And those demonstrations are in some strange, twisted way a legacy of 2013 and the year, because the World Cup wasn't well planned, and I think as a consequence of both 14 and 16, I think fewer countries and cities are now willing to throw their hat into the ring to do this thing, because people have seen that the political risks are huge, and the World Cup now it's increasing to 48 countries. There are hardly any countries who can do that anyway, So I wonder what's going to happen. It needs co-hosting and so on. The Olympics, it seems that there are fewer cities wanting to do it because not many have found a formula to make that work for the city. I think Barcelona in 92 would seem to be an exception. There's very little legacy from the Rio Olympics. The World Cup, it gave a network of stadiums all over Brazil. And some of the best new stadiums are the ones that had nothing to do with the World Cup. Some of them have been used, others really haven't been used and were never necessary in the first place. So in general, you're looking at wasted money more than any real benefit, and politically, I think they were hugely important as a kind of own goal. So I think that's the main legacy. But for everyone who was there, it was a fabulous party. No, it didn't need all of those stadiums. It didn't need, you could have done it. I mean, see, this is Brazil's fault. FIFA wanted to do it with fewer stadiums. It was FIFA wanted to do it with 8. It was Brazil who insisted on 12, you know. And it was Brazil who took so long choosing those host cities that the price of the stadium went up because you were doing it, trying to do it quickly. So the organization was absolutely lamentable, really, really lamentable. And it didn't have to be that way. Even with all, I mean, the contract that is signed is, you know, FIFA gets all the benefits and the host country takes all the risks. You know, it's a FIFA comes and just declares itself above the local government when it does that, which is highly questionable anyway, and wrong, I think. But there were a lot of errors on the Brazilian side of that process. It really wasn't well done at all, and as I say, it didn't need to be that way.
So obviously we're days away from the kickoff of Qatar 2022 and Brazil going to the World Cup as usual is one of the favourites. They do have a similar relationship to the World Cup that I feel Real Madrid have with the Champions League, particularly that the aura that they have with it. Where do you see Brazil in terms of the horses are just readying themselves for the get-go? Where are Brazil in your eye line?
I think they're justified favourites. It's the best Brazil side for a while, and they're very well coached. They're very well prepared. They've got little options, and they're bang in form. One of the things that makes this World Cup so interesting is the bar is set. Since Brazil won in 2002, every campaign has ended when they come up against the Western European side in the knockout stages. And as a result of the pandemic and mainly the Nations League, there hasn't been any football between Europe and South America, or very, very little. And in the case of Brazil, since the last World Cup, they played the Czech Republic 3 years ago, and that's it. So you don't know how to measure them against the best that Europe has to offer. And there are doubts, I think, again, about their emotional stability if they go behind. And also there are doubts that they've got a high press. How's that going to work when they come up against a Spain, for example, who can beat the press? We don't know. We haven't seen it. We're going to find out. We're going to have a lot of fun finding out. But as it stands, they're justified favourites. They've got great goalkeepers, fantastic centre-backs, and a range of attacking talents that have just come together at the right time, helping take some of that pressure off Neymar. They weren't bad 4 years ago. I think they were all right. They were unlucky in some respects 4 years ago, but they weren't bad. They weren't far off. For me, it was the game of the tournament, that quarterfinal against Belgium. And I think Brazil deserved the right to take that into extra time. They're better this time. So they're going to take some stopping.
Yeah, they've definitely got, I mean, you said there in the midfield areas and in the forward areas, there's a perfect blend, isn't there, of experience and young talent coming through. I mean, you talk about a high press. So surely Gabi Jesus has to be starting, right?
No, he's not going to play. No, he has. And here,
I don't want him to.
We wouldn't want him to play. You know,
because loads of people will say this, but here, I come back to the point about bad punditry of people not understanding the process. You haven't done the hours. You know, his last competitive goal for Brazil was 3.5 years ago. He has one goal in the last 20 games.
Yeah.
Richarlison has 7 in the last 6. You're the coach. Who do you pick?
Gabi Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, so he's not going to start, but, you know, the World Cup is like time speeded up. Your starting lineup at the start is not necessarily your starting lineup at the end. But what they're looking for from that centre forward is penalty area presence and nothing else. Gabriel Jesus is a more complete player than Richarlison, but they don't need that. They've got people to set up the play. And Richarlison is stronger in the penalty area. Gabi does quite a lot of his best work outside the penalty area.
Yeah,
they've got Neymar, Paquetá.
Neymar, Vinicius, Rodrigo. Like, they do have players that can create. It's just the person to put the ball in the net, isn't it?
Exactly.
And then in midfield, you've obviously got Casemiro, who's the old stud there, who just knows the drill by now. With Bruno Guimarães is in such great form.
It's going to be Fred.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. I know so. Yeah. That could change during the course.
But again,
people will be saying this. They haven't followed the process. They haven't seen how good Fred is for Brazil.
And how
United have misused him.
Right? I feel he's a scapegoat stuff. For United as well.
He's a scapegoat for bad analysis because they haven't got the best out of him. Mm. Obviously, they did recently when they were playing Tottenham, for fuck's sake. Why does that have to happen? I don't know.
If
you've got that lung power, get him running forward, committing opposing defenders, you know. And Brazil have said to him, because he said, you know, the coach asked me to cover for McTominay. What's the fucking point of that? You know, McTominay should be covering for him. He's the one with the lung power. So he's been very important for Brazil. And obviously, it's great for Brazil that Bruno Guimarães is in such form because it puts pressure on him. But if Fred is going to lose his place, and this is one of the big dilemmas they have in the coaching staff, it will be to Paquetá. Their most attacking variation has Paquetá playing as a second man in midfield. And that way they can fit in two wingers, Richarlison and Neymar. That really is pushing the boat out, and they're a little bit worried that might unbalance the side. But that's the way they're set up.
So to counter the process versus sort of current or club form, obviously, you know, we are Arsenal fans, so we have a lot of Arsenal listeners because we do a lot of pods about Arsenal. Gabby Martinelli getting in really because of the form and the club form of late. Again, not a starter. He plays wide left, and, you know, rumour has it Brazil have a few good players there. But what I understand there's been a bit of turning nose up to that selection versus some potentially have been part of the process for longer, should we say?
Yeah. Again, I said I was with the coach a couple of weeks back, and it was just after the Liverpool game.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to pick my 26, my squad. And I said, I can't find a place for Martinelli. I don't know how you're going to do it. And he said, yeah, that's a problem. Because, you know, against Liverpool, he was a man and a match.
I was there. I know. After season ticket holder, he was brilliant. He is brilliant. He's been brilliant this season. Andrew knows my thoughts. I always say this. I wouldn't take a third goalkeeper. You're seven games of football.
You have to. You have to.
You have to. By rules.
Yeah.
Oh, I would just say he plays in goal. I would just say he's
You can rotate.
So how are they gonna fit him in? Because at that point he wasn't in.
Yeah.
But he's forced his way in. Which, and this is nothing against Martinelli, I think they might regret. There were two ways they could get him in. One was not to take Daniel Alves and only to take one right back when you've got Eder Militão who can cover.
Yeah.
They decided against that. The other, someone's got to go. And the one who went was Firmino. And they've got lots of players with Martinelli's characteristics. They haven't got anyone.
No.
Let's say Neymar gets suspended, which is very, very likely. He picks up cards all the time. Firmino's your best fit for a kind of false nine to slip, you know, to make the extra man in midfield. He'll do that better than Neymar. And to slip those little passes through for the wingers, the way that he's done for years at Liverpool. And Neymar, so Firmino is your best Neymar substitute. And they've got rid of it in order to have yet another wide striker.
Anthony, so, I know wide right. Anthony could have gone.
Well, Anthony's done brilliantly for them as the process. You know, he's
I know, but this is what I said. We are talking about. This is why I asked the question, because it's an interesting one where it has gone against the process. And it's literally, you know.
Yeah, although Martinelli, he came through the Olympic side, and that Olympic side was very important for them. And the Olympic side has got Anthony in, it's got Bruno Guimarães in. They were promoted from Olympic side, and Martinelli was in the squad. The one I thought, as Arsenal fans, you'd be more interested in is the one who got left out, which is Gabriel Magalhães, I don't understand. I knew he was going to be out. I suggested to the coach last year, have you ever thought about playing him? In your first team? Because you haven't. He's a leader, and he gives you a left foot. And he said, no, I've never thought about it. And he had him in the squad for a while, but never got him on the field. And then in September, the last two friendlies, he left him out of the squad. And you knew then he wasn't.
Yeah, well, this is why, because
we gave up on that, didn't we, really?
Yeah, didn't think he was going.
I don't understand why. I don't understand. He hasn't won the trust of the coach. And I don't understand that one.
More than happy for him to be sitting on a sofa.
I'd have every single Arsenal player miss the World Cup and just be wrapped in cotton wool, to be honest with you.
Particularly this World Cup, but that's another story.
But you know, you're right. When managers, you know, we are talking about, I liked your phrase earlier, if the life accelerate, you're talking about a 5-week sprint only, but actually so much happens and squads change. But nonetheless, managers do go in with favourites. I appreciate that this isn't a 2022 preview, but what about England? Because England, another one where, frankly, there's a lot of favourites who probably shouldn't be on the plane and a lot of players in form.
It's coming on, Tom.
Yeah, that's another one where you're talking process versus actually picking form horses. I can't see England doing very well this tournament. Where do you see England?
Yeah, you certainly worry about the defensive unit, you know. And if he's, I think he can take Harry Mack, but only if you're going to play a three. And I can't see Harry Mack in a four. I think you can play him in a three. I think you can do that. See, the problem is if you start listening to the press and so on, and all on the moment, you have a different team every week, and that's not the way that it works. I am vaguely optimistic. I worry about the defensive unit, and I worry about too much being importance being placed on Harry Kane. You know, you wonder where the goal. I hope Phil Foden can explode in the national team in a way that he hasn't done yet, because I think he's an extraordinary talent. But I think it's part of the dilemma of this generation of England players. All of them are capable of operating at the elite level. They do every week. How many of them make it elite level? Because, you know, Foden now, there's no De Bruyne.
Yeah.
There's no Haaland. There's you. Can you really step up? And that's the question that you're asking about so many of those players. Some of them we know we can, you know, Harry Kane.
For example. They're still very, very young, aren't they? You know, players like Foden, you know.
I'm optimistic about a central midfield with Rice and Bellingham. I think that's interesting. Mm. I think it gives us a little bit more than Rice and Phillips.
Yeah, I mean, Jude Bellingham is different levels.
And you know, you're waiting for that group of strikers. Maybe this is Saka's time. You know,
you are waiting for Phil Foden and Bukayo Saka to replicate / explode. You know, Phil, Andrew and I are huge Phil Foden fans in terms of the level of the ability. But people almost gave him that build up before the Euros, the Gaza thing, the changing the hair.
Yeah,
but didn't really play. You know, and when he did play, didn't have the impact he wanted to. And to be honest, he never has an England shirt. Even probably less so than Saka has. You know, Saka's done.
Yeah, although the first time I saw him was in that under 17 World Cup win. He was just unbelievable.
He was unreal.
And we know he is. Responsibility's on now. You've had the Euros as a preparation. Let's see it now. Yes, he does. I'm prepared to give Southgate some credit. I think he gets a lot of flack, unnecessarily. I mean, no one else has managed to do what he's done in the last two tournaments.
And I think I think football fans, they can have good days and bad days in their views of thing of the same subject. And on a bad day, I'll say we go 1-0 up against Italy. If we go for that game, I think we win it. I think we win it 2-3-0.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, tired legs. We had the younger team, the fresher team. I think we suddenly realised the occasion.
We had Sterling giving away free kicks on the edge of our own box for crying out loud. It made no sense whatsoever.
We
didn't have a shot on target. And I just, you know, if we go for that game, once we've gone real up, if, you know, put them under it, I think we could be 3-0 up at half time. However,
I'll put that down as learning experience. I'll say, right, let's see it now.
And the fact is, you know, the resilience / slight defensive nature of Southgate, on the one hand, it goes and costs you in the final, but on the other hand, you may not get there without that. You know, so it's one of those things. So, I mean, again, as Arsenal fans, people often talk about Thierry Henry missing a chance in the 72nd minute against Barcelona to go 2-0 up when he's clean through in the Champions League final. However, I'm always quick to point out,
We love this story too.
We wouldn't be in the final without him. We wouldn't be in the final without him because he goes to the Bernabeu and takes the
I'm always happy to point out that one of the times that I met Belletti, I said, thanks for that, Cole.
Oh, no, don't. Well, it's been nice for you to join.
9 from 50, Belletti from 2.
We're struggling the connection here.
We'll have to edit that bit out.
It's actually quite funny, isn't it? We've, the title for this pod is 2014 Deep Dive, and as usual, as football fans, just football lovers, we've gone for a wonder, haven't we? Gone for
and
a wonder.
If I can just take you back to 20. That's where I met Thierry Henry in 2014. I was watching games alongside Thierry Henry in the BBC studios.
Animated.
One of the great memories. Go for the great memory, and then I'd love to hear your thoughts on France this World Cup. But you go for it.
It was the last night, and so I'd been at a World Cup final. Yeah. I've done it all now. I can retire, you know. I'd written all my stuff, and I'd done my radio, and I went. I was just shattered, absolutely shattered. So I had a little snooze for an hour or so, and I'd agreed to go along to one of the kiosks on Copacabana Beach to do some stuff for BBC World Service. And I really did, I don't want to go. You know, I just want to sleep for a week. You know, I don't want to go. But no, I dutifully set the alarm on my mobile, you know, and I got up in time and I went off to this kiosk. And I'm so glad that I did, because the highlight of 2014 was the Argentina fans. They invaded the country in such numbers. And it really was. It was a Latin American tournament, and the Mexicans, and a number of Mexicans, a number of Chileans, a number of Colombians. And we saw in 2018, Belgium played Panama in Russia, and there's more from Panama in the stadium than they are from Belgium. It's incredible. You know, the importance of the national team in a World Cup to and Panama is nearly South America. Kind of used to be part of Colombia until the states managed to wheedle it away. So these Argentina fans, they'd just taken it over, and they were singing this parody of a Creedence Clearwater Revival song. And it was the soundtrack to the whole thing. Now, Argentina have lost in the final, but their fans are still having a party, and everyone's fans are still having a party. And there's this collective mood of, while we don't go to bed, the World Cup is still happening. The party is still on, you know. We'll wake up tomorrow and it's all over, it's history. But while we stay awake, it's still going on. Yeah. And you got this big time from the Argentina fans who just lost.
Yeah.
And I thought that was brilliant. And that strip of Copacabana Beach was where the world met. You know, everyone who'd come to the World Cup at some point, they ended up on Copacabana Beach. So I was so glad that I'd hauled myself out of bed to go and do that radio thing, because there you're really seeing, you know, obviously the working it isolates you from the experience of the fan. But that was one moment of, for all of its faults, the absolute beauty and purity of bringing the world together in one place and let's all have a party. It was fantastic.
What a note to finish on, Tom.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, let's be honest, that's a way better place to party than Brazil, you know, and Copacabana Beach. And let's be frank, probably a party that will not be able to be had in quite the same manner of celebration of life in Qatar 2022. Tim, it's genuinely been an absolute pleasure. So thank you for joining us for a trip down memory lane, as well as a look at 2022. I'm going to ask you on the spot, Tim, who wins the World Cup in 2 weeks or 3 weeks?
Well, first, I think we've got to deal with even more urgent issues, which is that the Premier League is upside down. We've got to sort that out. at the start of next year. Who's going to win? Brazil's going to take some stopping. As I said, I'll put Brazil just ahead of Argentina. I'm interested to see Spain, though. And I thought in the Euros, I thought Spain were the best side. You just worry with Spain where the goals are going to come from. But some of those young midfielders, blimey, they can play.
Exactly what we said on the last pod, wasn't it, Tom?
Yeah. They're a striker short. They're a striker. They're a genuine striker's thought.
They completely outplayed Italy, didn't they, in that semi?
Yeah, it was a high quality game that, and yet they just couldn't put the ball in the net. But as I say, it's been an absolute pleasure. Enjoy. Are you going? Are you staying in Rio?
No, I'm staying here. Staying here.
Can't compare.
Which is great. You know, I'm doing a TV show on Brazilian TV every day. I am kind of counting on thinking, blimey, December the 19th will be nice.
Yeah.
I can have a lie-in or something, you know, because it's a drain. I was, you know, the poor sod who edits World Soccer magazine, he was thinking, how on earth am I going to do a guide next time to 48 teams? You know, 32 has killed me, 48. So, you know, it's the last 32-team World Cup, which is, I understand that 48 gives more places to Africa, and that's necessary, I think. But 32, from a mathematical point of view, it's just the right number. Yes. Even though it's so big that I can remember everything about, say, Argentina 78. I can remember that whole thing because you've only got four groups. You know, when there's eight groups, it's, you know, there's a reason that the musical stave has five lines, because that's the maximum that the human mind can assimilate. And you're just looking at the scores of 2014 today. Oh, yeah, I don't remember that. So it's almost too much. But I'm sure, with all the controversies about 2022, we'll get some moments that maybe we can meet up again in 15 years' time and reminisce over the fabulous moments from 2022.
And like you said, it's mid-season, which will mean it's different, but hopefully it means players are flying into it and we're going to see some attacking football and high energy, and people are going to be so spent that every game when they return to the Premier League, probably just going to be drawn. And whoever's top of the league, when we break for the World Cup, will probably
stop
win the league.
It's just disrupting the title charge, isn't it, really?
It is the absolute title charge, which will peter, but we'll enjoy it until then. Appreciate that, Tim.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot, Tim.